treating their cancer. Learn more at youhaveus.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jared Bowen in for Marjorie. I'm Jim Brown. Every time this next guest joins us, I say, thank goodness. Join us on the line to lead our monthly edition of the Afternoon Zoo, a conversation at the intersection of animal and human-animal behavior, is Cy Montgomery. Cy, of course, is a journalist, naturalist, and a BPR contributor. Her latest great book is Condor Comeback. Cy, it's great to talk to you.
It's great to be with you.
So we decided that we, with so much bad news, we would start with the good news.
Good.
We'll save the murder hornet for the end. But so last night, actually, I was having a socially distanced dinner with a couple of friends, and your email came through with your picture
pictures
of baby turtles. You stopped the table because we just had to, you know, I held up the phone, didn't pass the phone around just to show the friends your turtles that you're working with a Turtle Rescue League, the baby turtles. Tell us about this.
Oh, man. Well, this is really great news because baby turtles of lots of different species are hatching right now all over New England. And each one of these guys is literally a little miracle because they've already beaten such incredible odds just to be born. A lot of people don't know, but everything eats turtle eggs. Raccoons and skunks and dogs and ants and trees even eat turtle eggs. They'll send their roots into the eggs to drink their fluids. So just getting out of your egg, which can take up to 3 days and is an exhausting process, you have beaten so many odds. But there's a lot ahead for these baby turtles. They are so strong and brave. And without their parents anywhere near to help them, they know just what to do. And they have often very long treks to get to water. And this is where we can help them, because if you see a baby turtle crossing the road, you just pick him up and take him across, but do not take him home. I know they're so adorable, but I want to remind people that nature is not just a free pet store, and these guys need very, very specific things to grow healthy and strong, and it's difficult for a person to be able to raise a healthy and happy baby turtle. We get a lot of them at the Turtle Rescue League who were kidnapped essentially from the wild and have all kinds of health problems. Even, you know, people who love them and wanted to help them, but they have shell deformities and they have also like some kind of mental disabilities because they didn't get to learn stuff they needed to learn and their food was not right. But they are such darling babies. I had one hatch in my hand yesterday.
Oh, my God.
I know.
What's that feel like?
Oh, gosh. It's really great. Here is somebody who I was having snappers hatch in my hand, and they're round. Those eggs are round. They're not egg-shaped. And the little guy comes out, and he's shaped like the egg. So he's got this tall dome of a shell, which flattens out within hours. And first, when they start to hatch, you know, they have a little hole for their nose, and their little eye peeks out. And some of them look out, and they think, oh, I don't like what I see. And they stop for a while. But some of them just rip out of the eggs like rockets. And this little guy, after he got the little hole where he could breathe, and he looked out, and one hand came out, and then another hand came out. And then he's kind of sitting there with the back end of the shell on, like kind of a big diaper, and then he just shot out right across my hand. And, you know, this guy can live to be, if everything is perfect, like 175 years old.
Oh, wow.
So you are holding the future in your hand.
Hey, Simon Montgomery, what's an egg tooth?
Oh, isn't this cool? Well, they're as rare as hen's teeth. It's the only tooth that a turtle will ever have in its whole life. And it's this little bump that they use to hammer their way out of the inside of the egg. And eventually it goes away within just a couple of days of hatching. But you can see on an infant this little tiny white like dot of a thing that they use. They're born with that tool that then disappears.
Can people, you mentioned the Turtle Rescue League. My younger kid actually went to Costa Rica a couple of years ago to do something on beaches with turtles hatching and the photographs.
Oh, that's
were
great.
Just,
probably guard, like helping them get to the sea
I
and
think
not
so.
Running backwards to the where the hotel lights were.
I don't maybe
them.
I don't know. Whatever it was she was exultant. It was just it was great. But can real people, particularly in the middle of a pandemic, volunteer, see this, or is this off limits for people except like you?
Well, right now, they're not having people inside the building, but they desperately need runners. Because when a turtle is injured or when a baby turtle is discovered and the person realizes, uh-oh, I can't raise this, but I've had it for a couple of weeks and I don't know what to do, they need people who will get in their car and pick up that injured or stolen turtle and bring it to the turtle hospital. And they really need people to do that. Yesterday, while I was there, we had no fewer than 3 calls about injured turtles. One, 2 of them had fish hooks, and one of them had been hit by a car. And if it's not just right next to the Turtle Rescue League and somebody who's there can't run out and get it, this serves much of New England, all of Massachusetts, and even into New Hampshire. So
why are they able to live 175 years, Cy Montgomery?
I think they know how to take life slow.
No,
if
I'm
we
serious.
All could relax more.
There's got to be, I'm assuming you or your colleagues have written volumes about the longevity of these creatures. What's the secret? And is it transferable?
Yeah, it's not transferable that we know, or I'm sure that all the rich people would have done it by now. But I give a lot of thought to the passage of time in organisms and how they experience it and why some animals live for a really long time. I mean, not all turtles can live that long. Some can live longer. Some can live hundreds of years.
Wow.
But it has to do with how fast your cell metabolizes. Now, part of the reason that many turtles can live such a long time is that they spend a lot of time hibernating, a lot of time under the earth. In fact, baby painted turtles, the ones that most people call sun turtles, you know, because they're sitting out sunning on logs, they're the most common ones that you'll see. Those guys are hatching now, but they will spend all of fall and winter underground. The minute they hatch, they don't come up out of the earth. They stay down there, usually, for a while.
Is there a species that takes a year off, like maybe 2020 off, just underneath?
Yeah, wouldn't that be a good idea
if
we could do that? Yeah. And I also wonder, you know, is their experience of the world like, oh, boy, this is really dragging for me? With octopuses, you know, they only live 3 to 5 years, and that just seems insanely fast. And then there's little animals like shrews and hummingbirds with really fast heartbeats, and they generally don't live all that long. Shrews definitely don't live that long. Hummingbirds can live for a little bit of decent time. But to everything there is a season, right? So I hope that, you know, for these creatures who have short lives, that they still feel finished and complete.
Talking to Cy Montgomery.
Sounds like there's a Brazilian frog that's making the most of its time.
Oh, yeah.
For whatever time it has.
Isn't this great? I love, my poor husband, he often comes in and sees me watching sex videos of animals, but it's my job, you know?
That's what she says anyway. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, remember the pandas, Jim?
Oh, do I ever? Yes, I do.
Boy, and you turned on the sound, and I'm like, I know what that is. Those are pandas mating.
Yeah.
And that sound had been wafting up into my husband's office one day, wondering what that was. Anyway, yeah, this discovery was just reported of this Brazilian frog who does this thing that has never before been seen in amphibians. And he's a loyal husband and father, but to 2 or 3 females who all live nearby. And I love this story. I love all of these stories just because it shows us that there's lots of perfectly good ways to mate. Maybe things we haven't even thought about yet.
Well, isn't there actually, didn't you in your note to us mention, I hope I got this right, there's some sort of male fish that actually lives inside the body of the female? Is that right?
Yes.
What's the deal with that?
It's an anglerfish, and this particular species of anglerfish, which is a large group of fishes with many species, this particular group lives in really deep, dark water. And you know how hard it is to find a date during the pandemic? Well, if you live in the depths of the darkest sea, it's really hard to find a mate. So what the male has done to solve the problem is he burrows into the female's skin. And for the longest time, scientists kept pulling these things out of the depths of the sea and saying, there's nothing but females, but they have some horrible parasite attached to them.
That's great.
Well, that horrible parasite is their husband. And so he gets his nutrients from her bloodstream. But in return, when it's time for her to lay eggs, she doesn't have to search around for a male to fertilize them.
So can we, before we leave this topic, because I know that the sexual mores of animals are of particular interest to you, and actually by extension to me and maybe Jared, this frog thing that you two were talking about, who decides that I'm going to go study the sexual adventurousness, for lack of a better expression, diversity, of a frog in Brazil, and then is able to discern based on some level of observation that it's got multiple female partners? I mean, it is rather odd, is it not?
It certainly is interesting as, you know, being an accountant, I would think. And, you know, frogs have very interesting sex lives. They have 7 known mating positions, including one that the female reaches backwards with her legs to grasp onto the males, and this other, well, you don't want to know. Well, maybe you do.
I think we
know,
do,
but
actually.
Maybe we shouldn't discuss it. But they're really interesting for that reason. And to be able to sit in a beautiful rainforest, these particular Brazilian frogs, they live in seeps, which are rocky habitats. Uh-huh. And they're hard to come by, I think, which is probably why this mating system has developed, because the females kind of have to share, and the males will defend their habitat. They have these spine-studded thumbs and these big forearms, and they jab their thumbs at rivals to poke them away when they've found a really good rocky habitat to lay eggs in. So this is why you would, you know, consent to having a co-wife or even 2 co-wives. And frequently one of the female frogs is the dominant one, like the favored wife. But because these seeps are so hard to come by to lay your eggs in, it's worth it having to share your mate with one or two other females.
Apparently it is.
Yeah. Well, okay. And did I read she's kind of in control through the whole thing anyway? That she kind of identifies the male. Did I read that correctly? That she gets.
Oh yeah, she certainly knows who her mate is. Yeah, absolutely. And she knows who the co-wives are. I mean, of course they do. It's harder for people, you know, looking at frogs, looking at many species, people may have trouble recognizing individuals because they say, oh, they all look alike. But recognizing individuals, which used to be discouraged in sciences, in ethology, in the behavior sciences, used to be discouraged. But it's essential, because without knowing who's who, we'd never discover behaviors like this.
Wait a second. Why was it discouraged? Why was it discouraged, Si?
Oh, for the longest time, this was like prior to, 1960, basically, when Jane Goodall went into the field to study the chimpanzees at Gombe, people wanted to find out the animal behavior. So, first of all, you never named your study animals. You did not look at individual differences. Jane's first papers were rejected because she named the chimps instead of numbering them like rocks, because it was thought that you just wanted to find out how does a chimp behave or how does the chimp behave. Not, it really matters that this one is dominant and that one is submissive, and that this one is bossy, and this one is kind, and that this one is so successful at raising babies because she's so gentle.
So, but where does that come from? Because if you distinguish, you're giving too much respect to what the big boys consider to be lesser species. Is that what that came from, or what?
I think it might have come from it, and it also may have come from an attempt to be seen as objective.
Uh-huh.
So if you looked at animals like they were objects, you could be objective. You would not fall in love with them, and you wouldn't be accused of anthropomorphizing. But of course, you know, we're anthropoids. All of our behaviors arose from our ancestors who were chimps. I mean, they basically were fellow apes.
Mm-hmm.
So, Simon Montgomery, moving deeper into the water, they might not be polyamorous, but sharks like to have friends, it seems. They need lots of buddies?
I thought that was so cool. These sharks, you know, people think that they're these cold-blooded, unfeeling creatures. But they're smart. They do have a social arrangement. It's been shown in other studies that sharks get depressed. They can be happy. This particular study just came out. It was done at the Predator Ecology and Conservation Lab at Florida International University, and they studied gray reef sharks in this atoll in the Pacific between Hawaii and Fuji. And they put transmitters on 41 sharks, and two of them had like video shark cams. And they tracked these animals for 4 years. And they found that the same groups of sharks, which could be from 2 to 20 individuals, would return to the same part of the same reef over and over again together. And that they stayed friends for the whole 4 years. And, gosh, there's a lot of Americans who don't keep friends for 4 years. And they're not sure what all they're getting out of this. I mean, friendship helps survival. And this is why, you know, we have friends and why apes and monkeys and horses and elephants and whales and camels and hyenas all have friends. It's why humpback whale females have friends and remain friends for years. They've found with humpbacks that the humpbacks who stay with their besties raise more young successfully.
Wow.
Because when you hang out together and help each other, you can find food and care for your babies together. And so they think that these sharks have friends that might help them find food.
By the way, are you choosing not to tell us how many sexual positions they used in the 4 years they were together? Or you figured save that for next?
We'll save that. I actually, sharks have a hard time mating because when you don't have any hands and you have to hold on to your mate and they're all slippery, you know, you kind of have to bite them.
Mm.
So that's why female sharks, actually, a lot of them have thicker skin around the areas where the males will bite them to hold on to
true?
Them when they mate.
No,
yeah.
Is this it really is true?
Yeah.
You're unbelievable. So, Simon Montgomery,
well, I'm not doing it.
We have to. I didn't say you were. I didn't say you weren't, actually. I just. So, Cy, only because Jared let the something out of the bag, I read the same thing about what are they called, murder hornets or whatever, these Asian giant hornets. I read that they found a seventh one, and why do I care? I mean, who cares that there are seven of them? Is this because if there's seven of them, they could be 7 million of them at some point? Is that
There could be a lot more of them. It's so interesting. When they found this was the first male. The seventh one is
I didn't know that they had found. Okay.
Yeah, and they had set up 1,800 traps. And this is, I mean, with 1,800 traps, they found this guy. And,
is this in Washington State where they're finding all? Yeah, okay.
Right,
yeah.
It's around Puget Sound.
Yeah.
And the guy, of course, was delighted. because once you got to find these guys, you want to find a live one, and you want to put a tracker on it, and then it will go to the nest, and then you can wipe out the nest. And the reason that we don't like them is, you know, they're an alien species. They're from Southeast Asia. They're called yak killers, and yaks can weigh 2,000 pounds, so that does make it sound kind of scary. They kill honeybees. They decapitate them. They're not particularly aggressive, like, you know, the killer bees that everybody's really afraid of. Mm-hmm. But if they do sting you, it's extremely serious, and they can sting over and over and over. But I should tell people that there's a, and they're very large. They're 2 inches long. So they were delighted to find it because this gives them a better chance to track them back to the nest so that they can eradicate that nest before this spring's babies grow up to breed and disperse in the fall. But we do have, in New England, something that a lot of people see and they think, oh, my God, the murder hornets are here. And it's not a hornet. It's a wasp. It's big. And I don't know if you've ever seen this thing. But,
how big is big?
Oh, it's over an inch. Oh, over an inch long. And, you know, a lot of bees to our eyes, a lot of members of the, you know, the Hymenoptera family, they look similar. If you see a really big bee, wasp, or hornet, it makes people very nervous. But this thing is called the cicada killer wasp, and it hurts no one except for a cicada, and it's a harmless, docile, bigger wasp. If you picked it up or stepped on it, it would sting you, but it's no worse than a honeybee. But we don't have to worry in New England about murder hornets. If you see something that you think looks like, oh, my God, that is one giant bee, that's probably what it is.
Fair enough. Cy, as always, loved every minute. Thanks so much for your time.
Great talking with you.
See you soon.
Cy Montgomery is a journalist, naturalist, and a BPR contributor. She joins us every month for the Afternoon Zoo, and her latest book is Condor Comeback. Well, thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Of course, you can keep with us up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tune in tomorrow for Senator Elizabeth Warren, Andrea Cabral for Law and Order, and Paul Revel on all things education. Our crew is Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Connolly. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our offsite engineers are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. What's coming up on Greater Boston tonight?
Well, Governor Deval Patrick is going to join me about all the obvious things. So I won't even lay out the list, but he'll be with me. Well, Nelia Rivera was the chief strategist for Ayanna Pressley's congressional campaign. And she's got a great segment in this new collection of essays called Turnout Mobilizing Voters in an Emergency. She makes a pretty strong case that the coronavirus crisis presents this almost once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to dramatically change American politics, to expand the progressive base. So she will lay out her case. And we're also going to talk about how minority-owned businesses really got the short end of the stick when it came to these federal loan programs for small businesses. That's tonight at 7.
Well, it has been great to be with you yet again.
Great to have you yet again.
I'm Jared Bowen.
I'm Jim Browdy. We'll be back tomorrow. We hope you are too. Have a great afternoon. Bye.